And how beautiful it is to be able to connect that deep commitment to the sanctity and dignity of every person, regardless of color, class, sexual orientation, civilization. We're talking about a moral and spiritual revitalization of the country connected to the democratic renaissance of the nation. I don't know about you, but that makes me excited that that's taking place. Oh, yes. Yes. That's what I'm talking about. So I want to introduce to you, my dear brother, the one and only one connected to our movement. He's not an isolated individual, Pied Piper. He fights alongside us. He's concerned about wealth inequality, concerned about white supremacy, male supremacy, homophobia. He constitutes a grand wave in our movement on the way to the White House. My dear brother, Bernie Sanders.
The eyes with a will to see, where the hearts that run over with mercy, where's the love that is...
Wow! It sounds like Dubuque is ready for a political revolution. Let me thank River, and let me thank Mary, and let me thank my wonderful friend. Dr. Cornel West has dedicated his life to the fight for economic, social, and racial justice, and I'm delighted that he is here with us tonight. Let me begin by telling you what makes this campaign different from any other campaign out there. And Dr. West just made this point. And the issue is that given the reality of American politics today, something we don't talk a whole lot about, given the reality of the power of Wall Street, the power of corporate America, the power of the corporate media, the power of the huge campaign donors who are electing candidates all over this country, here is the truth. Not a pleasant truth, but it is the truth. No president alone can do what has to be done for the middle class and working families of this country by himself or herself. It can't happen. The only way we transform America, the only way we make this country the kind of country we know we can be, is when we have a political revolution and millions of people stand up together and say, enough is enough. And when young people and working people and seniors and blacks and whites and Latinos and Asian Americans, when we stand together, we have something the ruling class doesn't have. Yes, they have unlimited amounts of money, and I mean unlimited amounts of money. But we have the people. And when people stand together, we're going to win. Now, Dr. West touched on this issue, but this is a very profound an important point, and it's where our campaign is really very far removed from the other campaigns. And that is what we know and what every person in this room understands, is that real change, never takes place from the top on down. It always takes place from the bottom on up. In the early 1900s, when American workers were forced to work 60, 70, 80 hours a week where they had no rights, where they were fired arbitrarily, very brave men and women came together and they said, you know what, we're not animals. We are human beings. We want some dignity on the job. And they went out on strike and they fought. Some of them were beaten. Some of them died. But they were able to form unions to engage in collective bargaining. And that's the history of the trade union movement. And if anybody thinks that the civil rights movement is simply about, for example, Lyndon Baines Johnson signing the Voting Rights Act in 1963, if you think that's what the civil rights movement is, that ain't the case. The civil rights movement is 100 years ago when African Americans, under incredible pressure, had the courage to stand up and work with white allies. Do you know, in the South, it was illegal for whites and blacks to have meetings together? But they did. We were in, Dr. West and Jane and I were in Birmingham, Alabama, just a couple of weeks ago. And we went to that church where four beautiful children were killed by a bomb. You all remember that. What I didn't know, and I just learned 2 weeks ago, is we think, well, that was a terrible tragedy. A bomb went off in Birmingham, Alabama. It turns out that in that month alone, there were 14 bombings against African Americans. In 1 month, 14 bombings in one city in 1 month. And yet people stood up and fought back against segregation. That was courage. That's how change takes place. And all of you know, 100 years ago, women did not have the right to vote in this country. Women were second-class citizens. Women were told, you can't do this job, you can't do that job. If you get a divorce, you don't get the property. You are a second-class citizen. But millions of women and their male allies said, that is not what America is supposed to be about. They stood up, they fought back, they combated sexism. We have made enormous progress because of grassroots activism. Just give you a couple of more examples, because sometimes we take it for granted. We don't understand the march of history. We don't understand the struggle for change. Give you an example. Not so many years ago, when I was growing up, if a family gave birth to a child with a serious disability, there was shame in that family. That baby, as often as not, would be institutionalized and forgotten about. People were ashamed of having a child with Down syndrome or other disabilities. But people said, that's wrong. Those children are as important and beautiful as any other kind of child. And today, because people fought and people stood up, those kids with disabilities are now in our schools. They are loved. They are part of our community. I have been to many high school graduations where those kids get up and get their degree and the whole community is so excited. Okay? That is kinds of change. And I'll give you another example. If we were in this room Forget 20, 30 years ago. If we were in this room 10 years ago, and somebody said, you know, I think in the year 2015, gay couples will have the right to marry in 50 states in this country, somebody would have stood up and said, what are you smoking? Which actually raises another issue. But I want you to think about the kinds of changes that took place. So in a short period of time, historically, relatively few years, what was thought to be unbelievable, would not happen, could not happen, impossible to happen. We are too prejudiced a society. We will not accept gay rights. Suddenly, gay marriage is legal, made legal, trust me, by not a progressive Supreme Court. Okay? And it is made legal. Why is it made legal? Because the Supreme Court looks around the country. The world has changed. Virtually the entire younger generation doesn't even think it's a big deal anymore. It is what it is. The world changes. We should be proud of that. But that's how change takes place. That's how change has always taken place. But now we find ourselves in a very pivotal and unusual moment in American history. We can be proud of the changes that have taken place. And by the way, the state of Iowa is going to have an important place in history as part of change, and I will tell you why. When we talk about breaking down racial barriers, when we talk about, as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. reminded us, judging people not by the color of their skin, but by their character, who they are as people. 8 years ago, just at this time, 8 years ago, almost today, a candidate came to a virtually all-white state. And that candidate ran for president of the United States based on his ideas. And months before, people were saying, well, America's really not ready. Obama's an interesting guy, he's a smart guy. But America really is not ready for an African-American to become president. Obama came in to the state of Iowa, virtually an all-white state. He won here. You helped make American history. And why that vote was so significant, has nothing to do whether you like Barack Obama or whether you don't like Barack Obama. But what Iowa showed the world is that the people of this state were prepared to vote for a candidate based on his ideas and not his race. That's a big deal. So we can be proud that as a nation, in the last number of decades, we have made some pretty significant progress. Obviously, we've got a long, long way to go, but we have made progress in becoming a less discriminatory society. But there is one area where not only have we not made progress, we are losing ground, and that is the economic struggle. I want to Dr. West mentioned Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and I kind of date myself by telling you in 1963 I was there in Washington for the March on Washington. Yeah. And often, you know, when the media talks about it, they say, well, it was the March on Washington, 1963. The official title, Dr. West, correct me if I'm wrong, was the March for Jobs and Freedom. For Jobs and Freedom. And why was that? Why was that? Because Dr. King understood, and this is what he said, I'm paraphrasing him. He said, of course we must end segregation in all aspects of our lives. But he said, what does it matter if we desegregate a restaurant, but people can't afford to go to that restaurant? And all of you know where Dr. King was when he was assassinated. He wasn't on a quote-unquote civil rights march. He was in Memphis, Tennessee, standing up with unionized sanitation workers whose wages and working conditions were abysmal. And he was standing there with them to say that these people, even though they have lowly jobs, they collect garbage, that's what they do, but they are human beings who are entitled to dignity and respect. And some of you may not know this, but in the last months of Dr. King's life, what he was planning was an extraordinary activity. He was planning a poor people's march on Washington. And what he was trying to do was bring together not just African Americans, but poor whites, Native Americans, Latinos, all people. And he was saying that in this wealthy country, we have got to change our national priorities and create an economy that works for all of the people, not just the people on top. And he was also saying, and by the way, the extraordinary genius of Dr. King, the media doesn't talk about this too much, but the extraordinary genius of Dr. King was his courage. And what his mind evolved, and he said, you know, I believe in nonviolence, and therefore I am compelled to speak out against unjust wars. And ask the questions of why we can spend so much money on weapons of destruction when children go hungry. Now, Dr. West has just written a book on Dr. King, so I hope I got most of it right, right? All right. And here we are today. And while we have obviously made some enormous progress since Dr. King's death, and I think he would be extraordinarily proud that we have an African-American who is president, and a lot of the other progress that we have made, clearly, we still have a very long way to go. And all over this country, what you're seeing is an American people who are sad, who are angry, who are demoralized. And they're asking, how does it happen that with an explosion of technology and an increase in worker productivity, why does it happen that we are working longer hours for lower wages? Why does it happen that in my state of Vermont and in your state, we got people who are not working one job, they're working two jobs, maybe working three jobs, just to cobble together the income and the health care that they need? Why does it happen that in America today, when we're seeing a proliferation of millionaires and billionaires, we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of almost any major country on earth? Why does it happen, the American people are asking, that we have more income and wealth inequality than any time in our country since 1928, and it is worse than in any other major country on earth? In my view, it is immoral, it is unsustainable, and it is very bad economics. When you end up with a situation, I'd like you all to hear this, where you end up with a situation where the top one-tenth of 1% of Americans, one-tenth of 1%, now owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%. It is wrong and immoral when the 20 wealthiest people in this country now own more wealth than the bottom 150 million Americans, half of our country. It is wrong when one family, the Walton family of Walmart, owns more wealth, one family, than the bottom 40% of Americans. Now, when I talk about a rigged economy, an economy where the people on top one-tenth of 1%, 1%, get much richer while everybody else gets poorer, let me give you Walmart as an example. My Republican colleagues go around the country trying to divide the American people up, trying to divide the middle class from the poor. And what they say is, you see, the reason you're paying so much in taxes is you are providing all kinds of money to welfare chiselers. These poor people, they should be working. They're sitting home watching TV, taking your tax dollars. So let me correct the record. The biggest welfare chiseler in America is the wealthiest family in this country, the Walton family of Walmart. Now, why is that? Why is that? And here is why that is true. Today, Walmart is the largest private sector employer in America. Many, many of their employees earn wages that are just so low that they have to go on Medicaid, food stamps, and government-subsidized housing, which you, as middle-class taxpayers, pay for. In other words, you, through your taxes, are subsidizing the wealthiest family in America who refuse to pay their workers a living wage. So I say to the Walton family, get off of welfare, pay your workers a living wage. Ask ourselves why millions of our people are working such incredibly long hours, two or three jobs, 60, 70 hours a week. Husbands are working, wives are working, kids are working, marriages get in trouble because people are stressed out for financial reasons. Parents don't have the time to spend with their kids. And yet, despite all of that, 58% of all new income generated today goes to the top 1%. So are you ready for a radical idea? Together, we are going to create an economy that works for working families, not just the 1%. We are going to raise the minimum wage to a living wage, $15 an hour. And I know that every man in this room will stand with the women in the fight for pay equity for women workers. There is no rational economic reason why women are making 79 cents on the dollar compared to men. It's old-fashioned sexism, and together we're going to end that. Now, when we talk about the economy, it is not only the grotesque level of income and wealth inequality, it's not just low wages. It is the fact that real unemployment is not the 5% you read about every month. Real unemployment, including those people who have given up looking for work and those people who are working part-time, is close to 10%. Furthermore, there is a national tragedy that we never talk about. And that is, I asked some economists to study for me what youth unemployment is in America. Kids 17 to 20 who graduated high school. Here's what they reported back. If the kids are white, real unemployment, 33%. Kids are Latino, 36%. Kids are African American, 51%. Unemployed or underemployed. It is a shame. And why it is a shame is that everybody knows what do young people want. They want to, when you're out of school, you want to go out, get a job, you want to get out of your house, you want to stand up, become independent, and yet these kids by the millions are unable to find jobs. And that is a tragedy for them, but here's another tragedy. Today in America, as I think all of you know, we have more people in jail than any other country on earth. China, a communist authoritarian society, four times our size, has fewer people in jail than we do. And if anyone here thinks there is not a direct correlation between this outrageous level of youth unemployment and the fact that we have 2.2 million people in jail and that we're spending $80 billion a year keeping people locked up. If you don't see the correlation, you're missing a very important point. So here's radical idea number two. How about investing in education and jobs for our kids? How about keeping the kids in school and finding meaningful work for them rather than investing in more jails and incarceration? And when we talk about what's going on in American society today, it's important to point out that we have Republican candidates running all around Iowa, all over this country, talking about family values. Do you ever hear? They love families, can't stop talking about families. But I want everybody here to know what I know you already do know. When Republicans talk about family values, what they are saying is that no woman in this room, in this state, in this country should have the right to control her own body. I disagree. When Republicans are talking about family values, they're talking about defunding Planned Parenthood. As somebody who has a lifetime voting record in support of Planned Parenthood. I believe, no, not that we should cut Planned Parenthood. I believe we should expand funding for Planned Parenthood. And when our Republican friends talk about family values, what they are saying, as many of us fight to create a less discriminatory society, what they are saying is that our gay brothers and sisters should not have the right to get married. I disagree. Now, Jane and I have been married for 27 years. We have four great kids and seven beautiful grandchildren. And there's nobody I know who believes more in family than my wife, Jane. In fact, she's been running around Iowa doing a great job campaigning, but it is very hard to get her away from the grandchildren. I got to be honest about that. But when we talk about family values, our values are very different than Republican family values. What I talk about is ending the international disgrace of the United States of America being the only major country on earth that does not guarantee paid family and medical leave. Today in Iowa and in Vermont, women are having beautiful, beautiful babies, an extraordinary day for all of you who are parents, something you don't forget, pretty big day for the baby as well. But here is a real, real issue that we don't, like many other issues. I mean, what this campaign is about is forcing discussion about issues people have swept under the rug for years. And here's one of those issues. In America today, a baby is born today. If that mom comes from a working class family or a low income family, there is a great likelihood that in a week after she gives birth, or 2 weeks, she will be forced to separate herself from her beautiful newborn baby. And she'll have to go back to work in order to earn enough income to take care of the family. That is not an American value. That is wrong. That is why I am strongly supportive and will make happen as president 12 weeks of paid family and medical leave. And when we talk about real unemployment being close to 10% and youth unemployment being off the charts, it is clear to me that the federal government needs to initiate a massive federal jobs program to put Americans back to work. Brothers and sisters, we should be hiring teachers, not firing teachers. We should be creating jobs as we create a first-class childcare and pre-K national system. With an infrastructure, roads, bridges, water systems, and it's not just Flint, Michigan's wastewater plants, our rail system, levees, dams, airports, we need a massive amount of work to create the kind of infrastructure that makes us a productive and safe nation. A $1 trillion investment in infrastructure will create 13 million good-paying jobs. Now, my critics, and there are many of them, say, well, that's a great idea. How are you going to pay for it? $1 trillion, a lot of money. I will tell you how we're going to pay for it. We are going to end these outrageous tax loopholes that allow large corporations to stash their money in the Cayman Islands and other tax havens. Let me give you just a few examples of what I mean about a rigged economy and a grossly unfair tax system. Take three major profitable corporations, General Electric, Boeing, and Verizon. Since 2008, these three corporations have made a combined profit of more than $102 billion. And yet, in combination, they have not paid a nickel in federal income tax during that period. In fact, they got a rebate from the IRS. That is crazy. So we are going to end those tax loopholes, take that $100 billion a year, and put it into our infrastructure and create millions of decent-paying jobs. But it's not just creating jobs, it's preventing the loss of decent-paying jobs through disastrous trade agreements. Since 2001, we have lost some 60,000 factories in America, 60,000, and millions of decent-paying jobs. And one of the major reasons for that is that as a result of our disastrous trade policies, company after company has shut down in America, and they're saying, why do I want to pay a worker here $20-25 an hour? I can go to China, I can go to Mexico, I can go to some low-wage country, exploit workers there, and then bring back my product into this country. I say to corporate America, if I'm elected president, those days are over. If you want, you know, tonight you're going to turn on the TV and every major corporation in America says, buy this product, buy that product, buy, buy, buy. If they want us to purchase their products, the time is long overdue for them to start manufacturing those products in Iowa, in Vermont, and in America. What this campaign is about is ending a rigged economy, ending a corrupt campaign finance system, ending a broken criminal justice system. That's what the heart and soul of what our campaign is about and what we will address together if I'm elected president. Let me take a moment to just briefly tell you a story which encompasses all of that together. And that is that a few weeks ago, Goldman Sachs, one of the largest financial institutions in America, major Wall Street player, reached a settlement with the United States government for $5 billion. They reached that settlement, as other banks had done previously, actually larger settlements. They reached that settlement of $5 billion because they had defrauded the American people. They had defrauded investors by selling them worthless packages of subprime mortgages. Okay? And they reached an agreement, settlement with the government for $5 billion. In other words, what you see in that company, which exists in virtually all of the major banks, is massive fraudulent activity. In fact, you can make a very strong argument, I would make the argument, that the business model of Wall Street today is fraud. All right? Now that's point number one. Point number two is when we talk about political power in America, what we are talking about are during the 1990s, and I was on the relevant committee in the House, the Banking Committee, Wall Street spending billions of dollars to get deregulated. Billions of dollars in lobbying and campaign finance contributions, giving out money like it's water. They managed to get deregulated. They managed to get the government off their back. And I helped lead the opposition to that deregulation. But what they were saying is, let's get the government off our back. Let us go out and do our things. Let us have insurance companies and investor banks and commercial banks be able to merge. It'll be a wonderful thing for the economy. Well, they got what they wanted, and 8 years later, as a result of their greed, recklessness, and illegal behavior, our economy was driven into the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. Just a few years ago, a couple of years ago, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, who is a billionaire himself, who makes tens of millions of dollars a year in compensation, the guy comes to the Congress and he says, I want you to cut Social Security, cut Medicare, cut Medicaid, and give huge tax breaks to large corporations. That is called political power. What political power is about is the revolving door which over the last 25 years has allowed this particular company, Goldman Sachs, to send two executives and make them secretaries of the Treasury under a Democratic administration, under a Republican administration. Goldman Sachs, Secretary of the Treasury, finished, go back to Wall Street. And not only two secretaries of the Treasury, but dozens of other high-ranking government officials there to protect Wall Street's interest. That is called revolving door. That is called incredible political power. Third point, Goldman Sachs reached an agreement for defrauding because they defrauded the American people for $5 billion. Today, if some kid in Iowa or some kid in Vermont is picked up and arrested for possession of marijuana, that kid will have for the rest of his life a criminal record. But when a huge Wall Street firm pays $5 billion in fines, not one executive on Wall Street has ever been prosecuted. What that amounts to is not only are these huge financial institutions too big to fail, the bankers are too big to jail. Together, you and I are going to restore faith in our criminal justice system. We are going to bring justice to the criminal justice system. And no matter how high and mighty, no matter how rich or powerful, if somebody breaks the law, they pay for it. Now, I am the former chairman of the Senate Veterans Committee, and in that capacity, I have done my best to try to protect the men and women who put their lives on the line to defend us, to make sure they get the best health care possible and get the benefits that they have earned. And in that capacity, as chairman of the Veterans Committee, I had the privilege, the real privilege, of meeting veterans from World War II, Korea, all the way through Iraq and Afghanistan, people who have put their lives on the line to defend the essence of American democracy, which is the right of people to participate in the political process. It therefore breaks my heart to see us today politically with a situation in which, as a result of the disastrous Supreme Court decision on Citizens United, today billionaires, the wealthiest people in this country, are right now actively attempting to purchase the United States government and buy elections. That's right. So I want to say two things with regard to that. I come from a state where every March we have town meetings, just like this. People come out and they argue about how much money you're going to spend on the schools, how much they're going to spend on the roads and all that, and they vote. Each person has one vote. One person, one vote. Now, I may be old-fashioned, but that is what I believe democracy is supposed to be about. And in that regard, let me also tell you what the political revolution means in this campaign. Early on, when I decided to run, and I had to convince Jane very hard to do it. She's smarter than I am. She knew what would happen. But we got her on board, and we ran. And when we ran, we had a whole lot of problems. First of all, nobody in America knew who I was. That was a bit of a problem. Slight problem. Second of all, you know, what the media was saying is, like, well, Bernie, it's true, you comb your hair beautifully. You are a GQ kind of dresser. But despite those incredible attributes, we see you as a fringe candidate, okay? And then they said something which is true, and that is, look, sadly but truthfully, in today's political world in America, you need to raise hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, if not over $1 billion, to win the United States presidency. That's sad but true. And the only way, what I was told, the only way you raise that money is you got to go to the corporate America, go to corporate America, go to millionaires, go to billionaires, start a super PAC, and raise money from these guys by the millions. Well, we thought about it for about a tenth of a second. And what we concluded was, look, we do not represent the billionaire class. We do not represent the drug companies. We don't represent Wall Street. We don't want their money, and we are not going to have a super PAC. And it turns out I am the only Democratic candidate for president who does not have a super PAC. Who does not go to Wall Street or investment bankers in order to raise campaign funds. But that's fine. But then, good speech, how do you raise money? And we thought about it. And the conclusion that we reached is we would do it the old-fashioned way. We would say to the American middle class and working class of this country, look, We know that you are hard-pressed financially, but we are going to run a campaign to transform America. We need your help. And what blows me away, because I never in a million years would have believed that it would be possible, after 9 months in this campaign, we have received almost 3 million individual campaign contributions. And what I am extremely proud of is that I don't go around saying, well, I went to the investment bankers and I came away with $1 million or $5 million. This is what I will tell you. Our average campaign contribution, brothers and sisters, is $27. To paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, this is a campaign of the people, by the people, and for the people. And together, we are going to overturn Citizens United. Now, when we talk about where we are as a nation, everybody in this room knows that if our economy is to prosper, if our people are to have decent paying jobs, we need the best educated workforce in the world. It is literally beyond comprehension that in America today we have hundreds of thousands of bright young people who have the ability, who have the qualifications to get a higher education, but they can't go to college for one reason, and that is their families lack the funds. Now, Iowa, as it turns out, has historically been a leader in public education. And 150 years ago, it was a very radical idea for Iowa and other states to say, you know what? We believe that our kids should not have to be working in factories or on the farm. We want our kids to get a free public education, and that education should be first grade through high school. That was a very radical, bold, and an enormously important development in American history. Today, however, we are living in 2016, and today, in many respects, a college degree is the equivalent of what a high school degree was 50 or 60 years ago. That's a fact. 50 or 60 years ago, if you had a high school degree, you were doing pretty well, and you had great opportunities to make it into the middle class. In my view, given that reality, given the changes in the economy, the need for young people and all of us to have the education we need for the jobs of today, in my view, when we talk about public education now, we should be talking about making public colleges and universities tuition-free. When we talk about higher education, there's another issue that we got to lay out on the table that many people prefer to ignore. And that is the fact that we have millions of people in this country, some young and some not so young, who are struggling with oppressive student debt. Anybody here of student debt? Okay. This morning, it's been a long day, I think it was this morning, it was. At a smaller meeting, a young man jumps up, he said, He went to college for 2 years, $60,000 in debt. I was at a meeting recently in Iowa, young man, 29, married, two kids, works in sustainable energy. This is a guy really devoted to the environment. He owes $90,000 in student debt. He's paying more than 50% of his income in student debt every month. Talked to a woman this morning, working minimum wage or not much more. She thinks she's going to have to pay off about $1,200 a month in student debt. She hasn't a clue as to how she's going to be able to do that. Talked to a woman in Burlington, Vermont, whose dream was to become a doctor, working with low-income families. That's what she's doing, $300,000 in debt. A young dentist in Des Moines, Iowa, graduated dental school, $400,000 in debt. A guy 55 years of age in Nevada, he has been paying off his student debt for 25 years. He's more in debt today than when he started. He's worried that when he gets Social Security, they will garnish his Social Security to pay his student debt. Talk to a woman in New Hampshire. She said, Bernie, I'm not just paying off my daughter's student debt, I'm paying my own as well. This is the reality in America today. People are being severely punished. People are paying 20, 25, 30% of their income, paying off their student debt for the crime of what? For trying to get the education they need. That is absurd. That is totally absurd. And that is why in our legislation, what we are doing is not only making public colleges and universities tuition-free, we are also going to allow people with student debt to refinance that debt and get the lowest possible interest rates they can. And this will result in huge savings for people on their student debt. Now, my critics, of which there are many, they say, great idea, Santa Claus. What else are you going to give away? Now, how are you going to pay for this? $70 billion a year to do this, Bernie. How are you going to pay for it? I will tell you how we're going to pay for it. We're going to impose a tax on Wall Street speculation. When Wall Street's greed and illegal behavior crashed our economy, the middle class of this country bailed them out. Now it is Wall Street's turn to help the middle class of this country. I am a member in the Senate of both the Environmental Committee and the Energy Committee. And in that capacity, I have had the opportunity of meeting with scientists all over the world, the leading experts on climate. And let me just tell you what they have told me. The debate is over. Climate change is real. It is caused by human activity, and it is already causing devastating problems. As adults, as parents, as grandparents, we have a moral responsibility to lead the world, working with Russia and China and India all over the world. And what we have got to do is to take on the fossil fuel industry, and we have got to transform our energy system away from coal and oil and gas and fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. You are looking at a senator who was one of the first to oppose the Keystone Pipeline. I didn't have to wait on that one. who opposes the Bakken pipeline and the pipelines in New Hampshire and in Vermont, because we cannot continue the excavation and the transportation of dirty fuel. The United States is the wealthiest country in the history of the world. Now, very few people know that, because almost all of the wealth and income is going to the top 1%. So you don't have the time to understand how wealthy we are when you're working two or three jobs, or you're falling further and further behind, or your kid can't go to college, or you can't find childcare, or you're trying to live on $12,000 a year Social Security. But collectively, we are the wealthiest country in the history of the world. Now, it seems to me, and I say this as a member of the Health Education Labor Committee, that worked very, very hard on the Affordable Care Act. Now, the Affordable Care Act, to my mind, has accomplished many, many important things. What it has done is end this obscenity of private health insurance companies pushing pre-existing conditions. Remember pre-existing conditions? This is an obscenity which says that we will provide insurance to you so long as we're not going to insure what you need most for insurance. So if you had breast cancer 5 years ago, we'll insure you for everything except the possible recurrence of breast cancer. It's like getting fire insurance, except you won't get a payment if you have a fire. It is an obscene idea. It's gone. It is gone, and we're proud of that. Under the Affordable Care Act, close to 18 million Americans now have health insurance who previously did not. Under the Affordable Care Act, we have gone a long way to end discrimination against women who were forced to pay higher premiums because they were women. So we ended that. But notwithstanding those important gains, it turns out that we remain the only major country on earth that does not guarantee health care to all people. It turns out that today, despite the gains of the ACA, 29 million Americans have no health insurance at all. And, equally significant, many people in this room and millions of people throughout our country are underinsured with high deductibles and high copayments. Anybody here have high deductibles and high copayments? Okay. And what that means is that if you have $5,000 deductible, $10,000 deductible, what that means in real life is if you don't have a whole lot of money and you get sick, you're not going to go to the doctor. And when you don't go to the doctor when you are sick, you get sicker. And I have talked to many doctors in Vermont and around this country, and what they tell me is they say they see patients who come into their offices much, much sicker than they should have been. And the doctor says, why didn't you come in here 6 months ago when you first noticed your symptom? And people say, well, I have a high deductible. I just don't have enough money to spend hundreds of dollars for tests and go into the doctor. And what doctors will tell you is that some of those patients die, and that we lose thousands of people every year because they go to the doctor too late. Or what may otherwise happen is they end up in the hospital at great, great expense and a lot of human suffering. Now, I have been criticized for this, but let me say it again, and let me say it as straightforwardly as I can. I believe that health care is a right of all people, not a privilege. I believe, and I cannot understand how it happens that every other country, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Scandinavia, Canada, you name the country, they have all managed to provide comprehensive health care to all of their people. And here is an important point. At a time when 29 million are uninsured, when more are underinsured, when we pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, when one out of five Americans cannot afford to fill the prescriptions their doctors write, when elderly people are cutting their medicine, their pills, in half because they don't have the money to buy the medicine that they need, when all of that is happening, we are still paying much, much more per capita than are the people of any other country. We are paying, almost spending, almost three times per person what they do in the United Kingdom, where they guarantee health care to all. We're spending 50% more than the French guaranteeing health care to all, far more than the Canadians guaranteeing health care to all. And that is why I believe that this country must move forward toward a Medicare for All single-payer program. And when we do that, I mean, you know, what my critics are saying and what the argument is that, you know, Secretary Clinton is throwing out, these are ideas that are too ambitious. They can't happen. Yes, they can happen. And I want you to understand what it means. And this is what I mean by thinking big. If we go toward a Medicare for All single-payer program, and none of the experts who study this issue disagree, middle-class families will save thousands of dollars a year on their health care bills. But it's more than that. Do you know how many millions of people now stay at jobs they do not like because they have a decent health care plan for their family? Do you know how much time small and medium-sized businesses spend figuring out how they're going to provide health insurance to their workers? If we are able to do what other countries are doing today and say that health care is a right for all, if you're unemployed, if you're old, if you're young, if you're rich, if you're poor, what we do is free up millions of people to suddenly go out and do what they want to do, start new businesses. So whether or not my critics think we cannot do this, I believe that in our great country we can. But this is what we have to do. And this gets back to this whole issue of money and politics. Why do you think we are the only country that doesn't guarantee health care to all people? It has everything to do with the power of the pharmaceutical industry. Last year, the three major drug companies in America made $45 billion in profit. Insurance companies make billions in profit. The issue is not what should we do. The issue is, do we have the courage to take them on? Together, I believe we do. What this campaign is about is thinking big, not small. It is bringing millions of people together who are demoralized, who have given up on the political process, who have no idea about what their role in a democracy should be. Democracy is not a spectator sport. Professional football is a spectator sport. Democracy is a system that people fought and died for to make sure that ordinary people could control the destiny of their country and not just kings and queens and billionaires. What this campaign is about is not just electing a president. It is about creating a political revolution where working people and middle-class people and young people stand up and they say, you know, you see that flag there? People fought and died to defend that flag. And we are going to create a government that represents our interest and not just the interest of large campaign donors. That is what this campaign is about. Now, on Monday night, caucus night here in Iowa, the entire country is going to be looking at your state. There's all of this media here following what is going on, because they understand that the American people, and actually people all over the world, understand what is at stake here. Because, by the way, the problems we face in America, where the rich get richer and everybody else get poorer, those are problems that exist all over the world. Same thing. And where people all over this country and all over the world, as they look at Iowa, what they're saying is not just, you know, whether it's Sanders or Clinton or O'Malley, that's fine. But what is more important is, are the people of Iowa prepared to lead this country in a new direction? Are the people of Iowa prepared to say, we are going to end a rigged economy and a corrupt campaign finance system and a broken criminal justice system? I believe, based on the fact that I have been traveling all over this very beautiful state for the last 9 months, I have spoken at meetings like this in small towns and your larger cities. We have brought out over 60,000 Iowans to meetings like this. So on Monday night, with the eyes of America and the eyes of the world on this beautiful state, I hope very much that you will send a signal to people all over this country that you are saying enough is enough. We are going to take America in a new direction. We are going to create a government which works for all of us and not just the 1%. Thank you very much.